As Stephen Zunes journalist, in an article titled "Democrats Attack Amnesty Report on Israeli Regime to Justify U.S. Complicity in Human Rights Abuses." Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. What may have also provoked such a fiery reaction is the section of the report which appears to be referring to the United States. It reads, "Apartheid has no place in our world, and states which choose to make allowances for Israel will find themselves on the wrong side of history. Governments who continue to supply Israel with arms and shield it from accountability at the UN are supporting a system of apartheid, undermining the international legal order, and exacerbating the suffering of the Palestinian people." Unquote. It is this recognition that the United States has a moral and legal responsibility to end its support for violations of international humanitarian law committed by strategic allies that has led so many leading Democrats to side with the Republican right in its attacks on Amnesty International. This intensified in subsequent decades when the organization reported human rights abuses by U.S.-backed Latin American dictatorships and paramilitaries, exposed the massacres by U.S.-backed Indonesian forces in East Timor, criticized torture by U.S. interrogators in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere, and documented the large civilian death toll in airstrikes by U.S.-armed Israeli regime forces in the Gaza Strip and U.S.-armed Saudi forces in Yemen. This time, as an indication of the rightward drift of the Democratic Party, the Biden administration and congressional Democratic leaders have agreed with the Republicans that research documenting violations of international humanitarian law by U.S. allies can no longer be tolerated. They have decided to take the political risks of attacking the world's leading human rights organization and lie about the contents of its reports to justify U.S. complicity in human rights abuses. Why would so many prominent Democrats risk alienating so many people in their base, including millions of liberals who have long supported Amnesty and other human rights groups, by making demonstrably false charges against this beloved and well-respected NGO? Perhaps they assume that relatively few people will actually read the report, and that enough of the public will believe their false claims about it to undermine Amnesty's reputation for fairness. Amnesty's reputation for critiquing human rights abuses across the board has been one of its greatest strengths. The organization has been critical of human rights abuses regardless of the violator's ideology, geopolitical alignment, ethnicity, religion, or anything else. The organization's reports have fueled movements to end U.S. culpability in war crimes, which threaten the profits of politically influential arms exporters. Perhaps the Biden administration and its supporters are making these false accusations that Amnesty International actually seeks to delegitimize or unfairly single out Israel in the hopes that it will damage Amnesty's reputation enough that reports about violations of international humanitarian law by other U.S. allies will not be taken seriously either. If the Biden administration and Democratic congressional leaders can get away with attacking Amnesty International for its criticisms of the Zionist regime's violations of international law, they could also start attacking Amnesty for its criticisms of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and other U.S. allies. Given the preeminence of Amnesty International in the global human rights movement, this is nothing less than a frontal attack on the human rights community as a whole. Making statements that are so demonstrably untrue is a desperate attempt by Democratic Party leadership to destroy the reputation of the thousands of activists, researchers, informants, and others who have in many cases risked their lives to document human rights violations around the world. Even when Democratic leaders initially rejected calls for sanctions on white minority-ruled South Africa, they opposed military aid to the regime and were outspoken in their opposition to apartheid. By contrast, today, they support unconditional military aid to the Zionist regime, deny that the system imposed by that right-wing cabinet on the occupied West Bank is a form of apartheid and attack reputable human rights groups that present evidence otherwise. The Democrats figure that, with so many people scared of a Republican takeover of the House and Senate in November, human rights supporters will be reluctant to challenge their war on amnesty and other groups. This may end up hurting the Democratic Party, however. With Biden administration officials, both the House and Senate majority leaders, heads of both the House and Senate Foreign Relations Committees, and scores of other congressional Democrats joining Fox News and the Republicans in attacking, misrepresenting, and outright lying in an effort to discredit and marginalize one of the world's foremost human rights organizations, people may start wondering whether they can support both human rights and Democratic Party.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region which affect the governments, organizations, and especially the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss India's Nagaland, in which there is no war, but no peace either. And the eyes of Afghanistan on U.S. aid, while it has no access to its own assets abroad, mainly in the U.S.
Nagaland is an extremely remote state in northeastern India. It's surrounded by Arunachal Pradesh in the northeast, Manipur in the south, Assam in the west and northwest. There are some 50 million people living in this area, which is connected to the country through a tiny corridor called Siliguri. The area is geopolitically important to India too. It forms the country's borders with Bangladesh, Myanmar, Bhutan and China. Thus, New Delhi puts emphasis on maintaining security in the area, especially Nagaland, at any cost.
Nagaland is a northeastern Indian state. It is one of the seven states separated from mainland India, and Siliguri is the narrow corridor that connects the area to the rest of the country. Nagaland is home to over 2.2 million people, the majority of them Baptist Christian and English-speaking. Economically, agriculture is the most important activity, which accounts for some 70% of the state's economy. In 1947, shortly before India's independence from Britain, tribes in the state became united, and formed the Naga National Council. In 1951, a referendum for independence of the state was held, and 99% of Nagas voted for independence. However, central government rejected the vote, and guerrilla warfare broke out, and armed violence escalated since then. The Indian government and Nagas held the first peace talk in 1975. None of the dozens of peace talks in four decades led to a lasting peace, though. Still, they managed to bring down the level of violence. Nagas agreed to bury the hatchet, gave up their struggle for full independence, and accepted the Indian constitution. Dialogue resulted in an agreement signed in August 2015 between Prime Minister Narendra Modi and the state officials. It was regarded as a major breakthrough which could encourage the Naga groups to give up their arms.
Religion, language, and culture make the residents of Nagaland different from the rest of the country. New Delhi views the state as a veiled threat, especially after dozens of peace talks in decades did not produce a concrete result. An uprising in Nagaland remains a main concern for New Delhi, which knows that a minor incident in this region can trigger a national security disaster. Let's see how the central government is doing in this region.
On December the 4th last year, the killing of 13 civilians by the Indian Army hit the headlines. Local media reported that security forces opened fire on Nagas close to the border with Myanmar. The Indian Army issued a statement saying it had expected a movement of insurgents. Apparently, the forces mistook the civilians for insurgents. Nagas took to the streets in various districts, but the army yet again shot dead another civilian. It sparked region-wide protests in which the local leaders joined thousands of protesters. They demanded justice be served and a rollback of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, AFSPA. Under this act, which was passed into law in 1958, the Indian Army can search, arrest, and even shoot suspects, but federal approval is a prerequisite for prosecution by civilian courts. Human rights groups say the army abuses the law, which makes many areas feel like occupied territory. The December tragedy made the state's officials fiercely dispute AFSPA. Nagaland's assembly unanimously passed a resolution demanding the repeal of AFSPA, and the state's chief minister, Nipi Rio, said his government wanted to do away with it. Their efforts were in vain as the act was extended by the federal government. Naga officials fear this could impede future peace talks and their would-be results. Nagas who seek sovereignty or more autonomy experience no war anymore in their land, but no peace either.
Now we are joined by Dr. Saurabh Bhattacharjee, Associate Professor at National Law School of India, to further discuss the affairs in Nagaland. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhattacharjee. How do you view the peacemaking efforts taking place between Nagaland and the Indian government, and why is peace so fragile in this area?
Hello. The peace process has gone on between the Naga groups and Indian government for more than two decades now. And it is at a critical juncture at this moment because there seems to have been a deadlock between the government and the insurgents. Also, the nationalist government's hardline stance has in some ways reduced the scope for negotiation and compromise between the two sides. The situation in Burma may also lead to further instability in Nagaland and other adjacent districts. And the larger political crisis that the government is facing at this moment may actually reduce its options. So I think now it's at a very critical juncture with the direction over the next few years will tell us whether the peace process is going to end up in some sort of a success or whether it will end up as a failure.
So Dr. Bhattacharjee, what is your assessment of New Delhi's security policies in Nagaland?
Army's presence in Nagaland has had a prolonged impact on the fate of peace process, as well as the integration of Naga civil society and the community within the national mainstream. Army was introduced sometime in 1950s as a short-term measure to combat insurgency. And it's been seven decades since then that Army has remained in Nagaland. And that speaks of the failure of using army as a political tool when perhaps dialogue and negotiation might be more successful. Secondly, several commentators and Naga civil society groups have very persuasively argued that the level of violence in Nagaland has been very low since the ceasefire, despite few irritants, despite few incidents here and there. The level of violence that we see in Nagaland is much lower than what we see in some of the other Indian states. And yet we have kept army in Nagaland, and that reflects very poorly on the democratic rights of the citizens. And militarization in any manner is incompatible with principles of democracy, is incompatible with principles of liberty. And as citizens, they have a legitimate right to ask for demilitarization. And additionally, I must also emphasize on the fact that Armed Forces Special Powers Act provides army complete impunity, and no case can be filed against any army personnel for any human rights abuse, for any crime otherwise in connection with counterinsurgency operations without the permission of the central government. And that has been seen as a major bone of contention and is a major denial of right to life and liberty for Naga citizens. And from that angle, one must say that the removal of army is an immediate need to ensure that peace forces can move forward.
Dr. Bhattacharjee, do you see any grounds for optimism for the current status of Nagaland?
The special status does provide some rights to Naga state government as well as the civil society organizations, some space. But at the same time, if you follow the demands that have come from NSCIN, which is the armed group that is having dialogue with the government of India, one can see that there has been a constant demand for recognition of the unique culture and history of Naga community. And it's also been a demand for separate state constitution, a separate flag for their state, and for integration of other Naga areas with Nagaland in adjacent states. So that's something that is still very much within the concerns of Naga civil society groups. Additionally, Naga groups have also asked for removal of Armed Forces Special Powers Act and gradual demilitarization. And that is something that is required to be done before peace process can move forward in any effective manner. So from that angle, I think the current status that they have is not something that would satisfy most groups. In fact, the current status was put in place after a peace accord in 1975. But clearly that did not result in a long-lasting peace within Nagaland or within other Naga groups.
So how would you think the neighboring Indian states are affected by the affairs in Nagaland?
That's the trickiest part of the Naga peace process, because on one hand, there are some common concerns about autonomy, common concerns about recognition of cultural and historical rights of various states. So there has been an armed struggle in Assam for more than four decades. Mizoram, another state, saw very violent insurgency for more than two decades. Manipur also has a serious crisis of armed insurgency. So from that angle, I think there are a few commonalities that do apply between other states. And I think the longer history of Northeast tells us that there is a concern with respect to integration of these states within the national mainstream, and at the same time, recognition of their autonomy, unique history, as well as recognition of their cultural rights and demographic identity. But on the other hand, the peace process also revolves around unification of all the Naga areas. And a large part of the claim that NSCNIM, the armed group which is in negotiation with the government of India, has, is around adjacent areas from other states, including Assam, Arunachal Pradesh, Manipur, and they want all those areas to be integrated with Nagaland, and they call for a greater Nagaland. And that is something that is politically very explosive, because other states don't want to give up their territory. There has been also armed clashes between police of all the states. So it's not just a fight between the armed insurgents and the government of India. There have also been clashes between armed police of all the states. So given that history, I think it's a very paradoxical position with respect to the relation between the Naga peace process and the history of other states. There are commonalities and very acute differences that may make the peace process very violent and can have also very catastrophic impact on the relation between Nagaland and other neighboring states.
Dr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for being on the subcontinent. Now, let's take a look at people's reaction on this issue on social media network.
An Indian rights group based in Germany says laws like AFSPA are used to criminalize political agency of minorities in India. A columnist, social activist and academic says the December killing in Nagaland has made the repeal of AFSPA a pledge in election campaigns in the neighboring Manipur state. Anil Jha is a social activist who hopes Indians will soon witness the repeal of AFSPA, especially after Nagaland issues.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The world's eyes are on Afghans who are facing a freezing cold winter. Nationwide poverty caused by the collapsed economy is significant in the country. The UN's assessment says $8.8 billion are needed to build back the country. However, $4.4 billion of that are for the vital needs. In this dire situation, Afghans are fed with tiny international aid, such as the recent US aid of $308 million. This is while Washington has frozen Afghans' assets, nearly $10 billion in its banks.
The mainstream media is buzzing that the U.S. is offering a new sum in aid of $308 million to Afghans on humanitarian grounds. The White House says the aid will be handed to what it called independent humanitarian organizations. Washington says the aid aims to provide nations with shelter and food. The aid comes as the U.S. war-torn Afghanistan is coming closer to humanitarian crisis. The UN says in its 2022 response plan for Afghanistan that the country needs $4.4 billion to meet life-saving needs. It also estimates another $3.6 billion are needed for essential social services, including education and health. Following the takeover of Kabul by the Taliban last August, international funding to Afghanistan was suspended. Meanwhile, the country's foreign assets of billions of US dollars were frozen, mainly by Washington. This move meant an economic collapse for Afghanistan, as some 80% of the previous government's budget would come from the international community. The lack of funding has affected hospitals, schools, factories, and government ministries. The government employees, ranging from laborers to university professors, haven't been paid in months. On the other hand, the banks have limited the amount of money clients can withdraw. Hence, the nation is caught in a poverty trap.
The story of Afghanistan and the U.S. traces its roots back to the Afghans' war with the Soviet Union when the CIA created, armed and trained the militia in the region. Afghanistan today is a full-length portrait of the U.S.'s intervention. Decades of wars have had no concrete result, as it was the case in the last war. The U.S. started the fight with the Taliban in 2001 and the war ended with the Taliban retaking the country last year.
The U.S.'s seizure of Afghanistan's assets when Kabul is desperate is only one among many moves Washington has made. In fact, the U.S. has a long history of like moves. Waging war on the country and political interference in domestic affairs were the most significant among them. The United States' war on Afghanistan followed the September 11 incident in 2001. There were many ups and downs in the war's 20-year-long lifeline. It was also expanded to tribal areas in neighboring Pakistan. As Brown University estimated in April 2021, about 241,000 people were killed since 2001 in the Afghanistan and Pakistan war zone. Over 71,000 of the casualties were civilians. It was also estimated Washington spent some $2.26 trillion of Americans' tax in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Washington made considerable efforts to make Afghanistan strongly depend on the U.S. It backed certain people who would run pro-U.S. policies in the country's political structure. In the last few years of the war, Washington held direct peace talks with the Taliban, while no representatives from Kabul were allowed into the sessions. In 2021, the world witnessed the U.S.'s chaotic withdrawal of its forces from Afghanistan. Amid the pullout, Kabul rapidly collapsed. The Taliban were ruling Afghanistan when the U.S. first waged its war, and the war ended with the Taliban retaking the country.
Now, Mr. Subir Bhowmick, author and former BBC correspondent, is now joining us to provide more insight into the hidden side of the U.S. war on Afghanistan. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhowmick. Now, how do you view the U.S. aid flow in Afghanistan, and how could we know that the total aid is fully delivered to the Afghans and not spent elsewhere?
Hello, I'm Subir Bhowmick from India, and the answer to your question is, we really don't know why the U.S. is not going through the U.N. system. Because my country, India, is also sending a lot of humanitarian aid. We're sending 50 million tons of wheat to begin with to the Afghan people. And this will go through Pakistan. We have not had the best of relations with Pakistan, but on this issue, India and Pakistan has come together, and Pakistan is allowing transportation through its territory, 50 million tons of wheat for the Afghan people who are in all kinds of trouble. The thing is, there is an UN system, and the US apparently, you know, uses the UN system when it suits them more than anybody else in the world. But why this aid is not routed through the UN system is a million-dollar question. Why is it directly going to the Afghan government, which it does not recognize? You know, that's a whole big issue, actually. So it serves everybody's purpose if this aid is routed through the UN system, because then there is some kind of coordination and linkage between what the Afghan peoples want most and what they want somewhat less, and, you know, what is being sent to them. You know, the whole international aid effort for Afghanistan can be much better coordinated if it is routed through the UN system rather than bilaterally. The other point I would imagine is that when the Americans give any aid, you know, it's generally sort of in the interest of their own companies. So we have to explore whether there's a corporate angle to this whole thing, you know, whether the Americans are trying to send out some of their own surplus stuff, which does not have a market elsewhere, you know, in the world, to Afghanistan in the name of aid. That's something we need to figure out.
So, Mr. Bhowmick, how do you see the U.S. aid, and are they really aimed to address the fundamental needs of the nation?
No, we really don't know what the U.S. is going to send. If it's just giving money, you know, dollars, it's a bit of a contradiction, Mr. Jaffer, isn't it, that the U.S. is blocking Afghanistan's sort of bona fide foreign reserves, which are held in their country. You know, they're trying to block it for all kinds of reasons that they're forwarded. And now they're saying if they send, you know, cash aid, aid in terms of funds rather than material, then that's an issue. Secondly, if they're sending some material, you know, wheat or, you know, whatever, foodstuff or whatever else, then it's better sent through the United Nations, because then it's all coordinated. Otherwise, there is a possibility of duplication or replication. Let's say if the Indians also send wheat and the Americans also send wheat, then there is too much wheat and too little of other things that the Afghan people need. So maybe if the Indians are sending wheat, the Americans can send medicine. But this is better coordinated if it is done through the UN system. It's quite obvious.
So for helping out, why doesn't Washington release Afghanistan's central bank assets in the American banks?
Well, I don't really believe, that the U.S. is trying to do all this to ease the suffering of the Afghan people. The U.S. is always caught in the dilemma of, pursuing their big power interests, which they define very widely, often to the detriment of the national interests of other countries, and also, trying to sort of harmonize it with the humanitarian considerations that one expects of a democracy. So the U.S. is always caught in this kind of a dilemma. But here I would imagine that the U.S. there is a lot of optics involved, that the U.S. is trying to send humanitarian aid to a country which needs it, and where a lot of problems that the country now faces is because of the conflict in which the U.S. was embroiled directly. Yeah, first in backing the Mujahideen effort against the Soviet Union, and then sort of fight against terror. But the point here is one needs to figure out is whether the U.S. is doing it for humanitarian consideration, or whether it is trying to regain some kind of a diplomatic presence in Afghanistan, which is not available to them at the moment since their military pullout. So that's more possible than pure humanitarian consideration.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Subir Bhowmick for his precious time and insight. Now, let's see what people have been saying on social media.
A social activist argues Washington's freezing foreign assets is robbing the nation's wealth. Rahmatullah is a senior planning and reporting specialist at UNESCO. He criticizes the situation despite the US aid and other international aids. An NGO says it is hypocrisy to claim $308 million in US aid will go to the people, as the U.S. is seeking to retain presence through NGO networks.
And that was our episode covering India's Nagaland affairs and the U.S. war on Afghans. We will meet again next week. Till then, take care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Despite repeated warnings from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that the U.S. is driving the rise of tensions at Ukraine's eastern border, the U.S. Air Force has deployed four B-52 bombers with nuclear capabilities to the U.K. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Amid Ukraine Tension, U.S. Deploys Nuclear-Ready B-52 Bombers to U.K. Stay tuned for more. despite repeated warnings from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that the United States is driving the rise of tensions at Ukraine's eastern border, the U.S. Air Force has deployed four B-52 bombers with nuclear capabilities to the U.K., where one official acknowledged that the deployment is at least partially connected to Russia's recent military activities. Two B-2 Stratofortress aircrafts arrived at Royal Air Force Fairford recently, with two more following. The bombers integrated with other NATO members' forces en route to Fairford, according to the Air Force, including British Typhoon aircraft and Portuguese F-16, currently assigned to NATO's Icelandic Air Policing Mission. The U.S. military downplayed the deployment, saying it was a long-planned bomber task force mission, but one U.K. defense source told The Telegraph, is this aligned to current tensions? Yes and no. According to The Telegraph, a former British intelligence official noted that the Pentagon could launch airstrikes from Fairford as it has before. From Fairford, they could operate against a range of targets, troop concentrations in southern Russia and Belarus, Moscow, St. Petersburg, even the naval bases in the White Sea, the former official told the outlet, adding, in 1991, they hit Baghdad from Fairford, flew on to Diego Garcia, refueled and rearmed, bombed Baghdad again on the way back, and returned to Fairford. The bombers sent from Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota are capable of carrying precision-guided and nuclear weapons. As the bombers arrived in the UK, Joe Biden warned in an interview with NBC News that American citizens in Ukraine and Russia should leave immediately, while the US State Department issued a notice that it would not be able to evacuate Americans in the event of military action by Russia. Biden told Lester Holt, "We are dealing with one of the largest armies in the world. Things could go crazy quickly. That's a world war when Americans and Russia start shooting at one another," the president added. The United States regime has claimed Russia is poised to potentially launch an invasion of Ukraine, with tanks reaching Kiev within 48 hours of beginning an attack at the border. Russia's military has been conducting exercises near the border for 2 days after having assembled troops there in recent months. Russian officials deny having plans to attack Ukraine and have called on the United States regime to guarantee that Ukraine, a former Soviet state, will not be permitted to join NATO and for the alliance to withdraw troops from Eastern European countries, as well as other security assurances. The United States regime has rejected those demands. In addition to the B-52 bombers, the United States regime is deploying 1,700 troops to Poland, while British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace arrived in Moscow recently for diplomatic talks. In discussions with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss called on Russia to pull back its military presence at the Ukrainian border and de-escalate the situation. Lavrov said, "You first have to prove to me that we are the ones who created this tense situation. The West is trying to make a tragedy out of this, while increasingly it's similar to a comedy." Russian President Vladimir Putin told reporters recently that negotiations with the West are ongoing. economic divide.
The U.S.-NATO onslaught on Russia and the premise that Russia will invade Ukraine has brought to the fore political and economic dynamics, including energy, which has sent Europe scrambling, caught in the crosshairs of the U.S. militaristic approach towards Russia. Hi, I'm Omidor Shandil, filling in for Kaveh Tafoyi, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at how all of these scenarios can play out and whether this will really lead to U.S. isolation. Russia playing the gas card over the standoff on Ukraine. How Europe may cope if Putin shuts off gas. Around 35% of the European Union's natural gas comes from Russia. Meanwhile, European gas and energy prices are hitting through the roof. Then there's the issue of trade between Russia and Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Will Russia use the energy card to push for continuing trade between Europe and Russia? How will Europe cope or reject the U.S. on this, especially if sanctions were applied on Russia? Then comes the impact of war and sanctions on Russia. World energy prices like oil and gas will be affected, including food, metals, and manufacturing. Even the U.S. will be affected. Import of Russian oil have hit record high, despite souring tide.
Tensions are on the rise between the West and Russia over Ukraine. The U.S. and its allies accuse Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine.
I mean, I think we're looking at potentially the most significant conflict that we have seen since World War II. When you look at the kind of composition, the size, the capabilities that Russia is building up on Ukraine's border, it suggests that they're preparing for a relatively significant invasion scenario where they could possibly, you know, encircle Kiev and take half of eastern Ukraine. That's something we haven't seen in decades.
But Moscow has rejected the invasion allegations. The heightened tensions between the two sides has also had a huge economic impact on the involved parties. Ukraine says the panic created over Russia's alleged planned invasion is hurting its economy. Ukraine's economy is already in crisis mode. It needs as much as $5 billion to stabilize. Its currency, the hryvnia, has dropped 8.4% against the dollar. This is one of the worst performers worldwide since November, when Russia again massed troops on the border. The simmering tensions has negatively affected Ukraine's economy. Figures show that tourist arrivals to Ukraine have never recovered since the conflict first started in eastern Ukraine back in 2014. Foreign direct investments have also failed to rejuvenate since 2014. But the crisis is not limited to Ukraine and will stay there. Europe has a lot to lose if an actual war breaks out. European consumers are already paying higher prices for their energy, including gas and electricity.
President Biden, but also even more importantly, European allies, could figure out a new strategy on energy to try to gradually, but more quickly, reduce dependency on Russia, Russian oil and gas. Unfortunately, it's not going to help this year very much, except that if Putin knows that we're thinking about doing that, it creates more credibility that if he moves into Ukraine, that we will retaliate.
In Washington and European capitals, voices are getting louder for a comprehensive sanctions regime against Russia. The U.S. Senate is working on unprecedented sanctions against Moscow. EU countries have also threatened to follow suit.
Of course, it's very important to underline the principles of OSCE, as Ann Linde mentioned. And of course, we are preferring that the EU coordinates this kind of answers well, and EU countries have as unified views and opinions as possible. And this work is ongoing, of course, in Brussels.
Social media posts on the Russia standoff have been wide and far-reaching. This is probably the most extreme case of the world turning bipolar. The U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, tweeted, "It is Russia that has to make a stark choice. De-escalation and diplomacy, or confrontation and consequences." One viewer had this response posted from the Russian President, Vladimir Putin, albeit sarcastically, but maybe to the point. Moving on to the more important life-threatening issue of energy, Europe is stuck in a quagmire. Europe doesn't know what it will do if Russia cuts off its natural gas supply, this tweet says. This viewer poses a serious question for the U.S. If Russia cuts off Europe's energy, the U.S. says it will help Europe with Middle Eastern energy. Okay, but that energy was already bound for China. How do you help Europe without hurting China? You can't. Biden can't think even one move ahead. We have a couple of questions of our own. How can the U.S. guarantee energy to Europe? Where will the U.S. get its oil? Let's not forget, 11% of U.S. oil comes from Russia. Joining us in this segment is Stanley Esrall, an activist at the LaRouche movement. Stanley, welcome. The standoff between Russia and the West, i.e. the U.S. and the EU, has taken on a new dimension. Russia appears to be playing its energy card to assess the situation if and once U.S.-led sanctions are applied. What will Russia do if Europe goes along with the U.S.? Or will Europe probably back down and tries to maintain its ties with Russia, especially on energy?
Well, you have to realize that this is not what appears to be a struggle between the United States on the one hand, Russia on the other hand, and some people might think that Ukraine is important in that struggle, but you know, recently the Ukrainian president and others in the Ukrainian government have been saying they don't see any particular problem with, or difficulty with anything that Russia is doing. They think that Joe Biden is blowing it up out of all proportions. And the fact is that what we are up against is a global crisis, which is not a human rights crisis. It's not a crisis on, you know, how the individual rights of various people are being protected. It's not a crisis of who controls Ukraine. It's a crisis of, does the global financial network have control anymore? Do they? And this is something that has been building up really since the end of the Second World War.
Now joining us is Tim Kirby, a radio host and political commentator. Tim, welcome. Here's where things get a little crazy. There's a lesser known fact, and that's the issue of Russian crude exports to the U.S. U.S. reliance on Russian oil hits record high despite severing ties. Now, why then would the U.S. shoot itself in the foot by acting so crazily and aggressively toward Russia, not to mention the rest of the world?
Okay, well, first off, it's impossible to really cut off Russia's energy exports entirely. Europe can cut off the exports to Europe, which will, of course, have an effect on the Russian economy. But there's the whole rest of the world, and there's a big rest of the world. We have to also remember that sort of economic center of the planet shifts more and more towards Southeast Asia every year, which also means they have their own energy needs. So it would have an effect on the Russian economy, a negative effect. It's really been believed that all that the Russian economy has is oil and natural gas, okay? That's it. And if we look back to the sanctions policies going all the way back to 2014, it would seem to prove otherwise. You know, when the Soviet Union got sanctioned,
well, this is our info news section of the program where we review some economic news that we deemed important from around the world. Our first time is a look at inflation. How many times have we warned about this to plague the world, really? Starbucks, the ones that make coffee, announced we are forced to raise prices due to inflation and supply chain issues. At the same time, the company's profits went up 31%, and the CEO got a 39% raise. That sounds like companies are rebranding corporate greed as inflation. Moving on. Did you like the name Meta or Facebook? Well, Facebook has lost market share big time. It saw its biggest stock market loss of over $230 billion, also a record daily loss for a U.S. firm. Its shares fell 26.4% after quarterly figures disappointed investors. It makes you wonder how a name could be a game changer for the bottom line. Moving on, $8.4 trillion. That is how much tax-dodging billionaire dynasties could cost the U.S. The wealth hoarding by ultra-rich families would be equivalent
to over four code to build back better plans, according to this report. This would happen over the next few decades, citing loopholes like estate and gift taxes for the rich as the reasons. Now, our final look is at Canada. It lost 200,000 jobs in January, and the unemployment rate rose to 6.5%. This was because of the lockdowns and the mandates. But a lot of unwarranted blame is leveled against the truckers. Food services and hotels were among the hardest hit, with young people and women most affected.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is the in-depth section of the program, and for this section, we want to take a look at the impact of this crisis on Europe, then the world as a whole. First up, a look at the Russia-EU trade balance, in particular, EU exports and imports to and from Russia. EU exports about 89.75 billion euros, and when it comes to EU imports from Russia, that figure stands at 170 billion euros. The question that comes up here is whether Russia will use the energy card or not when it comes to Europe. Let's look at the temptation. First, a look at energy. Russia was the largest exporter of natural gas to the European Union in 2019 and 2020, the figure standing at around 35%. You can call this a good leverage, wouldn't you say? Secondly, there are concerns that Russia could be using this crisis to lobby for the newly completed Nord Stream 2 pipeline to come online by not sending more natural gas for Europe's storage. Nord Stream 2 is a major supplier of gas to Germany. Now comes the role that the U.S. is playing, a dubious one. The U.S. is desperate to increase its market share of natural gas. And what better way than to demonize Russia, then move in to replace Russia as the main supplier to Europe? The former U.S. President Donald Trump made no bones about that, even though he didn't name Russia by name.
Giving new meaning to the expression alternative energy, President Trump today told Europe's leaders that the United States is more than ready to be the continent's alternative energy source, an alternative, that is, to Russia, who the president suggested has used its energy dominance in the region to hold it hostage.
Let me be very clear about one crucial point. The United States will never use energy to coerce your nations, and we cannot allow others to do so. We are sitting on massive energy, and we are now exporters of energy. So whenever you need energy, just give us a call.
We are committed to securing your access to alternate sources of energy, so Poland and its neighbors are never again held hostage to a single supplier of energy.
Now, when Trump talked about alternative sources of energy and how the U.S. can replace Russian gas supplies to Europe, he was talking about fracking or shale gas production, something which the Russian president slammed. Now, let's have both of our guests rejoin us on this. First, to Stanley Esrell, activist of the LaRouche movement. Stanley, there is the issue of trade between the EU and Russia. The trade between the two is quite vital. Now, Europe is Russia's biggest trade partner. It actually accounts for 37.3% of the country's total trade in goods with the world in 2020. Obviously, there's not a strong desire for either Europe or Russia to have this trade stopped. Is Europe diverting from the U.S. on Ukraine for its own sake?
Not at all. And we are seeing that there are a number of leading people in Germany, in France, in other places, people who are experts on the economy, who have publicly pointed this out. The United States trade with Russia, you know, whichever way you go, whether it's, you know, U.S. to Russia, Russia to the United States, is 3 to 3.5%. Russian trade with Europe is, as you pointed out, in the range of 40% plus. So the United States, who is pushing this, has really nothing to lose by cutting off trade with Russia. Europe does.
Now, joining me is Tim Kirby, a radio host and political commentator. Tim, what do you think? The U.S. not to have that much to lose, as our other guests stated. And now, if that is the case, what can Europe do in order not to fall victim economically to U.S. warmongering toward Russia?
Well, again, this is a demonstration that, on the one hand, Europe always seems to be very united against dictators, in quotes, from other countries. But then when push comes to shove, they all want to work with said countries. And this is the perfect example where, despite sanctions that the European countries vote for, all the big businesses go around them. The sanctions really haven't changed that much. There are still plenty of European-owned factories operating in Russia. There's a lot of interchange between the countries, or goofy ways of getting around all these sanctions by selling something to Belarus and then the Belarusian sell to Russia, or through Switzerland or whatever. So even from the very beginning, if Europe was really, really deeply believed in this narrative that Russia is somehow this evil aggressor who's going to come and destroy them, their actions would be radically different.
Russia supplies about 30% of Europe's oil and 35% of its natural gas, which would be cut off in the event of conflict and possible sanctions. An actual war would significantly push up energy prices.
Considering that Europe is facing an energy, or better to say, gas crisis right now, making the long-term contracts you mentioned is significant.
Analysts believe oil prices could reach nearly $125 per barrel, with gas prices following higher.
Consequences for the energy market would be likely a further increase in prices of oil and natural gas, and therefore of energy costs more broadly for many countries in the world.
Furthermore, sanctions would surely complicate an already complex situation over Nord Stream 2, which is set to supply Germany with much-needed gas. Sanctions against Russia will badly hurt its economy, but would also be costly for the U.S. and the EU.
Ich würde schon sagen, dass Europa abhängig ist von russischen Gaslieferungen, aber wir importieren ja auch Öl und Steinkohle. Das ist sicherlich richtig. Auf der anderen Seite würde ich aber auch sagen, dass Russland noch sehr viel abhängiger ist von Europa, weil ein Großteil der Einnahmen in Russland durch die Energielieferungen fossiler Energien kommen. Und sollte das wegfallen, würde Russland sich massiv ins eigene Fleisch schneiden.
Russia is a key producer of agricultural products like barley, corn, sunflower, and rapeseed. Sanctioning Russia will likely increase the prices of these commodities.
In terms of headline inflation numbers, that certainly could keep headline inflation much more elevated for longer. Of course, we are hoping, like all of the international community is, that there can be a peaceful resolution to this issue.
Other key ingredients that the EU countries import from Russia include ammonia, potash, urea, and phosphates. Manufacturing supply chains also would not be immune from either a conflict or sanctions against Russia.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping and the Russian President Vladimir Putin met before the Chinese Olympics kicked off, and they displayed their anti-US stance in full force. The meeting between the two leaders was unprecedented in the message that both sent to the West, in particular the US. They unveiled a global alliance with an anti-US theme. They both condemned certain states' attempts to impose their own democratic standards on other countries. Another issue they addressed covered their bilateral trade and the US dollar, although this has been addressed by both before. This time was different since the political atmosphere was different. They announced the need to expand their bilateral trade in national currencies due to the unpredictability of the US dollar. This comes after the U.S. threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars due to U.S. sanctions in the event of an alleged Russian invasion of Ukraine. Militarily, the two countries pledged to cooperate more while strengthening their military alliance. And here's where China displayed its support.